Hi.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous from Miami, Florida, and I haven't found necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink, since January 25th, 1981. So I'm grateful for that. If you'll excuse me, I want to take this jacket off, if that's okay with you guys, okay? So let me just get serious, okay? Yeah. So, I never have any idea what I'm going to say, because if I start thinking about what I'm going to say, then I'll actually show up, and I pray to the Lord all the time. I say, please, God, just don't let me show up. You know what I mean? I'll screw this thing up like I've screwed everything else up in my life, and I just hope I know the Holy Spirit is working, because I believe in God, and I've turned my life over to Him, and He's never let me down. And that Dr. Bob, I think, in the big book says something like, if you're an atheist, agnostic, or any other form of intellectual pride that keeps you from this deal, I feel sorry for you, because your Heavenly Father will never let you down. And so I really appreciate being here, and it is a privilege to come here. I'm going to share a couple of things in the big book. This will probably be the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's going to be the best one I can do tonight. And since my job is not to carry the message, but only try to carry the message, I'm showing up, and I'm going to try to do the best job I can to be transparent with you and tell you about my deal. It's always sort of shocking to me. I speak a lot at different places, and it's always, interestingly enough, sort of shocked to me when they call me. You know, they call me and say, "Will you come on up?" Because I'm gonna lay it out for you, okay? Hopefully, you guys can take it. I have a sign in my office. You know, I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for 40 years, and I have a sign in my office set for my clients, because they're all crazy, and I specialize in crazy people. It's amazing that you had anxiety about this. I mean, can you imagine that anxiety with alcoholics? So I have a sign in my office, and it says, it's from the movie A Few Good Men, where Jack Benny says, "The truth, you can't handle the truth." And so I'm just going to tell you the truth. I'm going to let God decide and sort them out and everything. And, you know, the truth is, I'll probably piss about 10 or 15 or 25% of the audience off. But if I ain't pissing somebody off, that means I ain't saying shit. You know, so, you know, I just don't want to. See, here's the problem. I don't do this well. I mean, I understand what I'm saying. You know, like a good AA speaker for like a banquet or something like this is somebody that you walk out and you feel good. And you're happy and you laugh and say, "That one was great." And you don't walk out and say, "Who invited that asshole?" You know what I mean? That's my problem. My problem is, you know, there's a line that says, "Unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious and true happiness, he'll find none at all." And I understand, because I'm a big book guy. I understand. The longer I'm sober, it'll be 34 years. The longer I'm sober, the more my mind has turned from what I think to what the big book. The more I'm more in line with what they say in there. The way my thinking. I mean, I told my sponsor, "I know what you're doing. You're brainwashing." He says, "Well, maybe your brain needs washing." You know, and it's all about experience. And I've road tested this thing for 34 years. I drank for 15 years, but I road tested it for 34 years. Through the cancer, through the economic vagaries, through being married for 34 years, you know, to a wife that doesn't understand me, you know, treats me like shit, and raising four kids and six grandkids and running a law office, and she's a member of Al-Anon. She was going to be here. She was going to be here, but she says, "I don't want to listen to that horseshit again," you know, it's okay. Our ladies of perpetual revenge. You know, she knows how to do an Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it. And I told this last night at a group of my little. I have these gorgeous little grandkids, and when my little granddaughter Andrea, she's like 6 years old. I'm in my office at home, and she was staying over with us, and she came in. With a teddy bear, and she said, "Grandpa," I says, "Yeah, Andrea." He says, "What kind of fish are you?" I said, "I'm sorry, what?" He says, "What kind of fish are you?" I said, "What kind of fish am I?" He says, "Yeah, what kind of fish are you?" I say, "I don't know, Andrea. What kind of fish am I?" He says, "You are a selfish." You've been speaking to Grandma, haven't you? Yeah, so whatever. You know, my marriage got great. You know, after 15 years, my marriage got really great, because I finally realized that I am always wrong and I am the worst husband in the world. and I do never take out the garbage and all that sort of stuff. And once I admitted to it and I pled guilty to it, there were no more fights or anything like that. I just wanted to know what the fine was. It was always like a blouse or something, so I had to handle that, you know. So in any event, so the problem is that what we do in Florida, let me try to explain this. In Florida, I was brought up, I was brought up on something called step series. And I tried to explain this last night, I'm going to explain it to you guys. And that's what John was talking about, that's on rocketed.org. And what happens is in Florida, 34 years ago, and even way before that, what they would do is they would take people that had long-term sobriety, let's say, you know, 25, 30 years, something like that, or something, or people that, for whatever reason, people respected their sobriety and stuff like that, and they would have them do step series. So if you were a group, you would invite somebody like Eddie Edwards, you would invite Ray O'Keefe, or you would invite these guys that really, you know, conspire and talk about, and you'd invite them, and they would do a step a week for 12 weeks. So you would go to see Ray O'Keefe do a step series, and it was almost like taking a college course or ordering a college course, you know. It was like, I mean, you had a sponsor, but you could go see these guys, and for 12 weeks, every Thursday night, you would go to see Ray O'Keefe do step one, and then the next week you do step two. And the next week you do step three. And the next week you do step four. And go all the way through 12. And then you'd say, hey, you know, Eddie Edwards is doing it on Wednesday night. Then you go to Eddie Edwards. And then you go to this guy. And you go to that guy. And so the way I was brought up in Alcoholics Anonymous is we would go through these college courses almost, where you would go and hear different takes on different people doing the steps. It wasn't even so much that you understood all the stuff. It's just that you know, it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. You're not even ready unless you got a we, unless you develop some sort of person or people in your life and you say, I have no idea what the heck's going on with that guy, but I wish I could be like him. I wish I could have what he has. It's not that you put him in a pedestal, but we do. We do. We put them, we may not understand God. We may not understand his invisible qualities. It may not make any sense to us, but we sort of sense that whoever this God is, he's working in that guy. He may not be working in me, but there's something, this guy's on some sort of drug that whatever he's got, I don't got. And that's been going on in AA, and that's been going on in life for years. Recognizing that there's something somebody has, there's something doing that I don't got, that a person ought to have, that I want to have, and I would hang out with him. So even if I didn't understand him or how to do it, I knew that it was possible to get to that place. And by listening to him, I knew he was just as fucking nuts as me. Excuse the F word, but you know, there goes 10% of the audience. But I knew he was. That's just so that you know I'm not in church, so when I mention Jesus, you don't get upset. So the bottom line is, so what happened is you become a nut. You'd say, man, you'd have the want to, you'd have the desire. You see, I can do a lot of things. I'll talk about myself, my deal, and everything like that. But I can't give you the want to. I can't give you the desire. I can't give you what it is so that you leave your wife and you leave your home and you leave your kids and you leave this to go to an AA meeting because you really want this more than anything else. I can't give you that. I can't give you the deal where you go to an AA meeting instead of the Knicks game, you know, or something. I can't give you that. That comes from some other place where you have to get inspired or see that in other people and say, that guy has is more than anything, worth more than anything if I can get that deal. You know what I mean? So what happens is we did these step series in Dade and Broward County. And I thought that's the way AA was. We had discussion meetings where, you know, all us thumb-sucking crybabies, we get around and whine about shit. And we had, you know, speakers meetings, but it was the step series that I went to. And so I thought that's the way it was all over the world. So after about 3 or 4 years, and I started getting around and going to different places, I realized that I was talking about these step series, and nobody knew what I was talking about. I'd come to New York, and they'd say, what do you mean steps? What's a step series? And they'd say, we have discussion meetings, we have speaker meetings. We don't have any step series. We don't have this stuff, you know? So what happens is, I got involved after about 10, you know, after I started off pretty young, maybe 5, 6, 7 years, I started doing step series. I started being tapped to do step series and around. So I've been doing this stuff for like 20-something years, you know, step series. And they started recording me, you know, after I had about 15 years or something like that. And so there's all these recordings of all these series that I've done and all this deal. So you understand, in the step series, what happens is you get to speak to the same group of people, like a group like this, for 12 weeks. Well, you can, for 12 hours. You know, and this is going to get really good, by the way, in the sixth hour of this talk. But I was going to do my talk on humility, my world famous talk on humility, but I never do it with really a group this small. So I get to do it with a group of people for 12 weeks. So for 12 weeks, they get to know who I am, what I am, and everything about it. So what happens is, after about 3 or 4 weeks, they're pretty comfortable with the fact that I'm crazy. And, you know, I mean, you know, let me tell you something. And once they realize how nuts you are, they say, I'm going to listen to whatever he says because he's one nutty son of a bitch. You know what I mean? And because, you know, there's anything that alcohol doesn't want us to be talked down to. And if you're an alcoholic, it says, unless until an alcoholic, you know, accepts alcoholism, like I said, and all its consequences, sobriety will be precarious. There are a lot of consequences to being an alcoholic that have nothing to do with drinking. Drinking is really just a symptom of our disease. Drinking, I drank because no woman, no suit of clothes, no amount of money, no job worked just as well or just as fast as just a few drinks. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, discontent, sober. Unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. I drank because nothing worked like alcohol. And if alcohol did for me what it did today, what it did for me when I was 18 years old, I'd still be drinking. But alcohol doesn't work for me anymore, so I don't drink. And the sad part of my life is it stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me. I hurt a lot of people, you know. But you want to some all that other stuff. There's other consequences to alcoholism that has to do with stuff that centers in your mind, not your body. And I can stop drinking, but how do you stop thinking? I mean, I don't have a spare brain. If it's in between my ears, I don't have a spare brain. You know what I mean? I don't even realize I'm nuts because you know something? As crazy as I am and as crazy as my thoughts are, they're my thoughts. I've been thinking this way all my life, and I feel comfortable thinking crazy. As a matter of fact, you put me in a room like this and try to teach me how to think non-crazy, I'm uncomfortable thinking non-crazy. I'm more comfortable thinking crazy, but the problem is when I think crazy, you know, I start feeling restless, irritable, discontented, and also I didn't even experience alcoholism until I was sober. Who experiences alcoholism? You know, I don't know about you, but I don't know what alcoholism is, but if it has to do with me feeling restless, irritable, discontent, so, you know, feeling sorry for yourself, feeling bored, feeling whatever it is, I never experienced alcoholism because as soon as I felt the first urge of alcoholism, I said, I need a drink. And when I said I needed a drink, it wasn't like, wouldn't it be nice to have one? It said, pull the flipping car over, you know? I started feeling relief as we were pulling into the parking space of the bar. You know, I mean, you don't experience alcoholism when you're drinking because you're either popping those pills or smoking that joint or drinking that deal or doing whatever you can to get rid of the alcoholism. And it's all about committing suicide, really. It's all about death. You know, Carl Messinger in the 1930s, around when the big book was written, wrote a book called Man Against Himself. And on the chapter on alcoholism, he said, alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. You know, it's about thinking, you know, I wish, you know, the first thing I started, you know, when I stopped drinking, all of a sudden I started thinking about killing myself. I'll tell you when you find out about alcoholism, you know, I'll tell you, I was 6 months sober and I used to say things like, now I know why I drank. You don't find out why, you don't realize why you drink until you stop drinking. And you have to deal with the horse shit without the booze. You know what I mean? And you just realize that it has to do with your thinkings and your emotions and your perceptions and all that stuff. And it's like natural. It's like those crazy emotions. And it's like being right-handed. I can't get rid of thinking the way I think. And, you know, I mean, I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. I'm stepping on the toes of others and they retaliate. You know, usually without propagation, I'm though I usually don't think so. I don't think so. I really don't think so. You know, you don't understand. You know, you don't understand. Above everything, I must get rid of this selfishness. I must, or it kills me. It doesn't even hurt, it kills me. God makes that possible. I thought, I read Playboy magazine. I thought that gal would make it possible. I thought you know what I understood the consequences of alcoholism? You know, even though drinking was something that I used, I could also use women, I could use cars, I could use jobs, I could use money, and I did. I used all those things. I mean, there's a lot of consequences to being an alcoholic, to feeling crappy about yourself. I mean, you'd be driving in a car, and all of a sudden you hear a voice, and it says you're an asshole. You're a jerk. You ought to be dead. You turn around to find out who's saying that shit to you, and you're the only one in the car. And that's your life.
That's you talking to you about who you really think you are. And even when you've got the radio on, the TV on, and all that stuff going on, so that you are, because you can't stand silence, because silence is bad thoughts about yourself and other people, and you got all this stuff doing with your text and sex and whatever it is, so that somehow you're not paying attention to what a bullshit piece of crap you are. You know what I mean? The bottom line is that doesn't go away to Venus. That's not being beamed in. That's inside of you. Don't even worry about the committee. You guys have to. You ever have to go to a meeting where they say, "Well, it's the committee at work." Oh, I've got the committee, you know, in my brain. You know, don't worry about the committee. At least you're invited to the meeting. You know. You gotta worry about the executive secret committee that's real deep down inside and throwing up shit in your mind, saying, "Yeah, I know that gal tried to stab you, but you ought to marry her." You know, I mean, that kind of shit. You know, we're 10 years down the road, you're saying, "How did I get myself in this stupid job?" And you know, you realize that you're the one who applied for it. You know what I mean? And, you know, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it's all about experience. You got to do this thing. This is experiential. My sponsor used to say, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will walk away with an experience. And that's the deal. So I've rotated this thing for 34 years. You know, I drank for 15 years. And you know, I could tell you all sorts of drunk logs, and that's what AA entertained. And I'm not putting down this deal because this helped me out a lot. The identification thing, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then I drank. But the bottom line is, you know, I've been sober, working a program, trying to get through the cancer, the money problems, the wife, the kids, the job, the deal, everything that you guys deal with in your life, sober, physically sober. I've been dealing with the consequences of being an alcoholic. The consequences of feeling when you feel like you're, you know, I was a nothing. It didn't matter. I graduated Department of Laws and Mathematics, National Science Foundation Fellow. You know what I mean? I was the smartest guy in the room. Graduated law school, division chief of the Attorney General, trying murder cases. It didn't matter. I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. I was nothing but a nothing. I used to put something in my body that turned me into an almost. When you're a nothing, almost is top of the world. You're telling me this stuff is the problem. It's the only thing that ever made me feel okay. There was always something missing. I always needed something. Needed something to live. I know I always needed. How could you make good money? And I made good money and always be broke. Well, when I was 10 years old, my sponsor told me something. He said, when you spend more money than you make, you go into something called debt. Did you know that? I was a math major and I didn't know that. And I didn't know why my secretary had more money than me. He used to say, simplify your life. And I knew what that meant. Get rid of the Cadillac. You can't afford it. But how could I do that? What would people think? You know what I mean? I spent more money maxing out my credit cards, you know, buying shit I didn't need to impress people I didn't even like than you could possibly imagine. And so did you. And I didn't know I did that, because you got to do that, because you have to have this, you got to have that, you got to get that, because if you don't get that, you're a piece of shit and you're going to feel like crap and nobody's going to get that. You worry about losing that stuff. And I didn't know that that's alcoholism, just as much alcoholism and a consequence of alcoholism. I didn't know that compulsion to buy this and have that and get this and not being okay here right now, that was all about alcoholism that goes on even after you stop drinking. I didn't know that I drank because I deep down inside I thought like it was a piece of crap. And drinking was like committing, it's like committing suicide. That's what it is. I don't want to die, but you know, I really do. I just don't want to, like Woody Allen, I don't want to be around when it happens. You know what I mean? I want to die, but not really. I used to, when I was drinking, I remember towards the end when I was drinking, I drank alone. I used to be a bar drink, but then I drank alone. And I didn't want anybody between me and the booze, and I couldn't afford it anyway. And I'd scrape around for a few pennies, and I'd get $2.89, and I'd go down to the Winn-Dixie, and I'd buy a gallon bottle of Carlos Rossi Gigante, and I'd sit by the radio, the LP, we had LP records then. Most of you guys don't even know what that is, but it's big black things. And I would listen to the same song over. I'd pick a song. You know, I had Alkie songs. You all had Alkie, you know, like Pirate Looks at 40, Running on Empty, Only the Lonely, you know, I'm Mr. Blue, you know, anything by Karen Carpenter, Rainy Days and Mondays, and I would listen to the same record over and over again, which was difficult, because then what happened was the needle gets it, then you got to lift it up. And you got to move it over and put it back. And I imagine myself singing in the bar, and I imagine all the gals that I loved, you know, that spurned me. They were all around me. And then I think about myself in the coffin, and I'd be dead. It'd be my funeral, and all the gals would be there, you know, feeling, you know, saying, "Why did we treat them the way we did?" And you know.
Yeah, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like, but
I was a self-pityaholic. I was a self-pityaholic. That's a consequence of being an alcoholic. To be an alcoholic, consequence is being filled with self-pity. You know, believe me, everything was about, you know, 90% of the thoughts I have are totally unnecessary and not about me. But I make everything about me, and the 10% that are about me, I can't do anything about anyway. There's like 1% that I can do something about that I need to think about. It usually has to do with going to the bathroom or eating. And so I pretty much got my life narrowed down to going to the bathroom and eating, and that's it, you know. And things are working out okay. You'd be surprised how little you have to know in order to be well in this deal. But a consequence of being an alcoholic is being a thinkaholic. I don't know anybody who's come up to me, who I sponsor, I sponsor quite a few, who hasn't gone through a bad time where there wasn't an inordinate amount of thinking about bullshit. You know what I mean? Thinking about crap. You know, and that's just the way it is. I used to go to my sponsor would say, I'd be mad and upset because somebody bounced a $500 check. Bounced the $500 check, he's getting out of the head. He'd say, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I'd say, what are you talking about? Well, you know, sponsors are stupid. I had stupid sponsors. You know, nobody's, you know, I was supposed to be sponsored by Albert Einstein and Jesus Christ, and they weren't around, so they gave me some used car salesman who never even graduated grade school. But, you know, when I came to Dallas, I had like two neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other, you know. And so, you know, you took whatever you get. I was vulnerable. I got this guy to sponsor me, and he was, you know, he was mean to me, and I mean, he was abusive. Well, you know what happens with abused children? You become an abuser. And so that's what, you know, he would, I tell the story, I invited him into my office once. I have all these degrees, you know, clients like to see that. I mean, a whole wall like this covered with degrees, educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. And I said, Bob, I was about 3 months sober. I said, Bob, these are my degrees. He said, well, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees. You know what they do with those. So. One time he told me, I made a decision. I used to go to the bar at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd come at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd come out at 4 o'clock in the morning with a wife and kid at home. I'd spend 12 hours at a bar. It was like nothing. I mean, it was like almost natural for me. You know, so I was, as soon as I came to AA, I knew one thing. I knew I had, if you ever hear go to any meeting, he says, I need to have some balance. I had a word about balance, you know. I don't want to go to too many meetings, turn into one of those crazy people, you know. And so I decided, I thought it out mathematically after about 3 months, that I need to go to meetings on Thursdays. I don't know how I figured it out, but I figured it out, you know, because I'm a rationalizer. I tell myself rational lies, things that make sense to me. Things that, you know, make sense to me, things that I want to do, you know. I mean, I know it says, I know, what does it say? It says, we cannot manage our own life. Does it say that? Does it say we cannot manage our own life? Yeah. Right? Yeah. Does it say new human power can relieve our alcohol? Does it say God could if you saw it? Yeah. Well, if that's the truth, how come I used to get in my car after all the meetings and knock all that stuff and then sit around trying to figure out how to manage my life? If right after those three statements it says being convinced of these things, being convinced, how can I say I'm convinced when I spent the next 15, 20 years trying to manage my life and being all upset and saying, why aren't things working out? Well, look for that person that was going to fix my life. When the book says, only God could would if he was sought. You know why? Because it takes about 15, 20 years before you get convinced. Because it takes about 15, 20, 25 years before you're convinced. And by the time you're convinced, and you are convinced that God could and would if he were sought, that see to it, your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. When you're convinced of that, then everything falls into place. Because nothing else matters, because you don't have to worry about what they think about you. You don't have to spend 8 hours saying, you don't have to do that shit that two psychiatrists that cross themselves in the hall, one says hi and the other one says, I wonder what he meant by that. You don't have to worry about what people are thinking about you or what they're going to think about you, what's going to happen. You don't have to, you know, because that's the whole thing, because you're selfish and yourself. It's all about me, 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 me. Me, Tony, enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me? What are you going to think about me? What are they going to think about me? What do you think about this talk? You know what I mean? Me, 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 me. The terror and the bondage that is me. How do you get rid of the drinking? How do you get rid of the me? How do you get rid of the 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about this and worrying about that? You know? How do you get rid of that? How do you go through all that stuff? 3 o'clock in the morning, you got a wife and 4 kids, you got $50 in the bank, you don't have enough money to pay the mortgage. How do you get rid of that shit? How do you do that? You toss and turn, you know, you think your life is over. What are the neighbors going to think? What are your friends going to think? What are the lawyers going to think? What are people going to think? How are you going to do it? You don't know how to do it.
You're either going to turn to a drink, be a thumb-sucking crybaby, start popping Xanax, or go to a doctor, a psychiatrist, or whine and cry, or you're going to say, help me, Lord. You're going to say, help me. You're going to turn to the Lord. You're going to turn to God. And you do that about 5,000 times, and everything works out better than you can possibly ever imagine. All of a sudden, you know, after 20, 25 years, you start believing in Him. That He's never let you, because you know what Dr. Bob said. He said, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. But it may take some time for you to actually really believe in this shit. You know, things take time. So in any event, what I found out is, getting back to, I take these right turns, that they don't do these step series in other places. So I'm a pretty crazy kind of guy, and I'm used to not doing this kind of speak. I used to taking groups through step series. So when you're taking a group through a step series, they pretty much know who you are and what you are and everything, so you can pretty much bring them along to what the Big Book is really all about. That's why I like Big Book. So by the time you get the third step, you can really start talking about the main deal, which has to do with God, and turn your life over to Him. Not the higher power, God, and turn your life over to Him, the Creator. You know what I mean? But it says you can talk about not the kind of day you heard about this morning in some meeting where some guy had been sober for 20 years and he was whining and crying like a thumb-sucking crybaby because he was worried about money and all about himself because he told me he didn't really believe in this God stuff. But you can start focusing on the real AA, the AA that these guys are doing when they say rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You know, the AA that they were talking about in Dr. Bob and Good Old Timers, when they used to get you down on your knees before you got to a meeting and say, give your life over to God or else you're not getting into the meeting. And they didn't worry about whether you wanted to do it or not. The question was whether you wanted to go in the meeting. And the meetings might have been a little smaller, maybe not everybody went, but they were hellacious meetings. Because the people were pre-qualified. There was not a lot of talk of, you know, against God and stuff like that. Those kind of meetings. You know, Dr. Bob, the Good Old Timers, where it says, you guys know the Big Book was written in 1939, right? A started in 1935, right? You remember that guy, the man on the bed? You guys ever see that poster, the man on the bed? That guy was Bill Dodson. He was Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. There's a story, and I'm going to read something from the story. He was the man on the bed. They show a picture. If you look at that man on the bed, there's Bill Wilson, there's Dr. Bob, and there's the man on the bed, Bill Dodson. And Bill Wilson is holding a Bible, because that's what they used. Because, you know, when they say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, how many alcoholics do we have in here? Raise your hand. How many alcoholics want to thoroughly follow their path? So, in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, they said the books that we found absolutely essential during those 4 years was 1 Corinthians 13, the book of James, and the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. So I suppose you guys are studying that shit. Yeah, so that's the problem. That's the problem. They did all that stuff. They were steeped in the Bible. Sam Shoemaker, who was with the Oxford Group and was Calvary Church, was tutoring Bill Wilson. Ed Dowling, the Jesuit priest, was tutoring him. The whole thing came out of the Bible. And the bottom line is that if you mention that in any room, they want to shoot you. They don't want to hear about God. They want to sort of water it down and everything like that 75 years later. And they wonder why these guys who were steeped in that stuff, that they wouldn't even let you go into a meeting unless you got down on your knees and give it all over to God, that said stuff like, there is one who has all power, that one is God. God either is or He isn't. That they weren't ashamed to talk about that stuff. And these guys said, if you do what we did, you'll get what we got. Which is, we were rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. We experienced much of heaven. This God was doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And they wonder why they're not getting that same deal. They're just getting physically sober, but they're not experiencing the joy of living when they're not doing the deal. When they're doing basically group therapy or staying sober on the fellowship. In 1950, there was an essay written called Strong Cup of Tea, where it was discovered the vicious little talked about secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's, I'm going to tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. The secret is that you can stay sober and not do the steps. There are millions and millions of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are staying sober on the fellowship. You know, what you do is you sit around and you talk about bullshit and you drink coffee instead of beer. And you make believe you're sober and you say, put the plug in the jug, and You're 15 years sober, you're going through your 15th divorce, you're not paying your child support, you raised 15, you know, children and killed 5 rabbis and a priest. And they say, well, you haven't had a drink today. He says, no, he says, you're a winner, you know, and they can give you a triple medallion, you know. And that's what they do. So the point is, there's actually a point here. I'm going to read a couple things in the big book so you actually get some real stuff. The point is, so I get 12 weeks to go over this stuff with people so they don't hate me so much. You know what I mean? Because this isn't entertaining, right? This is like, it's almost like you're lecturing, but you don't mean to lecture, because what you really want to do is you want to impart to something, you want to impart to people something that saved your ass that you know they may never get because it's not being talked about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know that the most important thing is that you try to carry a message, and the message is of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you really stop caring about what the people don't like you, because one of the things that the Lord has lifted from me is that absolute desire, that consequence of Alcoholics Anonymous, that zeal that says everybody's got to like you, or you got to be loved, or you got to be accepted, and you're more concerned with whether God accepts you. Because as Bill Wilson says, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, got to keep talking about it and telling other people. So you got to figure out whether you're going to tell them the truth and what's really happened in your life and what happened, or you're going to feed them the bullshit so that they'll laugh and they'll say, that guy was a good speaker. And the problem is, over 12 weeks, you understand what I'm saying? I can do it in such a way so that slowly but surely people really understand where I'm coming back from. It's hard to do it in 45 minutes or an hour. You know what I mean? So I just have to get right to the point, and you're going to have to, you know, just this is going to bear with me, but this is what I'm going to do, because when I go down to Miami, whether they like me or they hate me, I want to at least know that I gave them the message. You know what I mean? I didn't water it down. So when they asked me to do this thing, I don't know if it was John who called me up. I think it was John who called me up. He said, well, we'd like to come up and do this thing. I said, because really, I got to tell you something. By the third week of my step series, we're dunking them under the water and baptizing them, you know. So they're loving it, you know. And I'm a Jewish kid from Long Island. So we're talking about all sorts of crap, you know. We're talking about all this stuff. So in any event, so when John said you want to come up here, I always say this. Do you know anything about what I, you know, I mean, do you, I don't know if he remembers it. I said, John, do you know what I do? Yeah, I mean, have you heard any of my case? He says, yeah, I said, no, John, no, I'm serious. I mean, have you heard, you know, I'm the guy who bring the Bible to meetings. I talk about, I'm like, he says, no, they want you. So, and I can see that the nature of this group and what heard in the beginning and what's going on, you guys are big book guys. That you want the real deal no matter what. And listen, if you're disturbed, just remember the spiritual axiom. Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. So if I'm disturbing you, you owe me it's like a spiritual MRI. You know what I mean? I've now pointed out something in you that's disturbing you, that's a problem, and one of two things will happen, because I know a little bit about this disease. You'll walk out of here and you'll say, that son of a bitch, I hate that guy. Who invited him? I don't listen to this bullshit. This is about religion. This isn't about that or anything like that. Who invited him? And you'll get mad and you'll cop resentment and you'll ultimately drink or die or something like that, be miserable for the rest of your life. You know, whatever, which won't hurt me, you know what I mean? Or you'll get mad, you'll get pissed off, and you'll do what we do. You'll write down resentment. Why did that guy piss me off so much? I felt like he was talking down to me. He was saying, well, what was he saying? And then you'll do the fault thing. And also, you'll talk to your sponsor. You'll pray about it. You'll say, I live in the internet. Somehow, some way, you'll see something. You'll say, man, you know, like what that guy was saying? You know, I hated it. It made me feel good. You know, something, there was a little bit of truth in there. And then you'll see the truth in it. And then 7 years from now, you come up to me and say, I remember I first heard you up there in Yonkers. You know, I used to hate you, but now I love you. You know what I mean? And you'll find out that when you lose the resentment about me because of what I said, because of something I touched in you, when you discover that thing that touched in you that caused you to hate me, because you know alcoholics who feel secretly insecure. You know, the worst thing you can do to somebody who feels secretly insecure and feels like a piece of shit is treat them like they're secretly insecure. But you know, the bottom line, you don't want to talk down to them or anything, you know. And the bottom, you'll find out that thing, whatever that thing is, that you got fixed because God fixed it, because you looked at it and you said what it is and you prayed about it and it got fixed. You'll find out that there's a million other people out there and things going on in your life that was doing the same thing. As soon as that thing gets fixed, all of a sudden that shit, all of a sudden you'll notice that people aren't bothering you anymore. That not only you're not hating me, but you don't hate that crazy brother-in-law of yours, you don't hate the cops, you don't hate that, because whatever it is was fixed was also driving you nuts in the world. And that's how it works. That's how AA works. You know, you got to have a live alcohol going through shit, going through the world, working these steps and turning towards God. So let's see how much of this stuff is actually, let's see if AA backs up any of this crap. You know what I mean? Let's just look at the book. Okay, this is on page 25. I'm going to read about four things and then I'm going to go on because I want to see, I want to make sure I'm on track with this stuff. Because I want to make sure I'm going to try that. It says right here, it says, we have found much of heaven. We have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we did not even dream. The great fact is just this and nothing less, which, you know, I'm an attorney, I'm a wordsmith, and I'll tell you what I think that means. This is just my opinion. I understand. I think when it says the great fact is this and nothing less, I think what they mean is that the great fact is this and nothing less. I mean, I know you've got your program and I've got my program and all sort of stuff, but you know, the truth is there's only one program. There's not 16 million programs, okay? The great fact is this and nothing less, that we have had a deep and effective spiritual experience which has revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today. You know how you can tell what the central fact of your lives today is? What you think about. What you talk about. What your conversations are about. If your conversations are about getting laid, or look at that blonde in the front row, that's the central fact of your life today. If your conversations are about money, that's the central fact of your life today. If your conversations are about your business, that's the central fact of your life today. If the conversation is about all that bullshit that got you in here in the first place, and you're still talking about it, that's the central fact of your life today. I'm just reading from a book. Hey, listen, I'm just saying. You know what I mean? Don't blame me. Don't kill the messenger. Just tell them to rip that shit out of the book, you know? Then we don't have to pay attention. It says here. It says the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty. Not maybe or perhaps or I don't understand. The absolute certainty. There it goes again, being convinced that you can't manage your life. No human power. God could and would if he is. God either is or he isn't. What is our decision to be? Hey, listen, the AA, I don't know whether you're an AA. I mean, just because you're sitting in the garage doesn't mean you're a Buick, you know what I mean? Just because you're here. The AA I belong to takes a stand on atheism and agnosticism. It takes a stand. It says this kind of thinking, they wrote one chapter to the agnostics and atheists. It's called Chapter 2, The Agnostics. It's pretty easy to find. Now, I'm going to give it to you real straight. This is what they say. Here's the. You're in New York. I'll talk to you like a New Yorker. This is the bottom line. This sort of thinking has to be abandoned. When people say, well, I'm an agnostic, it's not AA. Can we kick them out? No, because the only requirement, hey, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking, period, end of story. I wouldn't kick anybody out. But listen, there's another requirement. There's another fellowship in AA. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's called the Fellowship of the Spirit. It says you'll meet some of us in the Fellowship of the Spirit. You can go to an AA meeting. You can be a member of AA. It doesn't mean you're a member of the Fellowship of the Spirit. He says you'll run into some of us as you trudge that road in the Fellowship of the Spirit. That's a whole other deal. That's about people who are experiencing the joy of living. If you're seriously alcoholics as we were, it says right here, it says the central factor of lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we can never do by ourselves. So, yeah, here it is. It says, exceptions to say, this is the guy, Roland Hazard, remember Roland? He went to the doctor, he did the whole thing, he knew the inner workings of his mind, drinking was like impossible. On his way back home to Philadelphia, wherever the hell he was going, he passed through Paris, got drunk, went back to the doctor, what's going on? He says, is there no exception? He says, exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics who have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. That's the doctor saying, I don't understand them. They're like miracles. They're like a phenomena. I don't understand them. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements or rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangements within you, with many individuals. My methods are successful. I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. He's talking about you guys. You should be interested. God couldn't would if he were sought. Must get rid of the selfishness. Must or kills us. God makes that possible. How does that turn into you can do it on your own? You can do it without God. So let me read just a couple more things, and I would just want to go on with a few more things and that you know may or may not be important. We'll see. Page 68. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. To go to an AA meeting and to sit there and listen to whining and crying for 45 minutes an hour and have nobody mention God, I'm wondering whether I'm actually in an AA meeting. I just wonder. For we're now on a different base, the base of trust and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. I walked out of a meeting once. Guy came up to me. He said, "Are you Russell?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, my sponsor says you're a good speaker. I had to hear you." He says, "But you talk too much about God." I don't know what else you talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're like in a different, and that came from his sponsor, because it made his sponsor nervous. You know, a lot of people will say things, "Well, we'll chase the newcomer out to where? Like, where's he going?" So go out and he'll drink. He'll come back with a new attitude. I'll tell you who really gets nervous: the guys with 10 or 15 years. It's not the newcomers. The newcomers love this shit in Miami. They want to hear this crap. They want to hear a message of depth and weight. They don't want to hear the same old bullshit. They want the real deal. What scares the people are the guys with 5 or 10 years that aren't doing this shit, because the bottom line is if you talk about this crap, then they got to say, "Well, why aren't I doing it?" It's like that new cup of tea thing, you know? So let's talk about what's really going on. It's the guy with 10 years, the guy I saw this morning with 15 years who hadn't done his 4-step yet. Those are the guys that get nervous. The guys that it's all about just not drinking and staying dry because of the fellowship. But believe me, that has its consequences. You can stay dry for 15, 20 years, but the bottom line is you're not going to experience what these guys experience, the joy of living, being rocked into the fourth dimension of existence. You're going to be that guy. I know what it's like to be an alcoholic, constantly thinking about yourself, worrying about yourself, thinking about what other people think about you, and then tell yourself the lie, you know, you don't give a shit what other people think about you. That's all we do. We sit around all day saying, "I don't give a crap what they think about me. I don't give a crap what they think about me." Let me tell you something. If you've ever said to yourself, ever, "I don't give a crap what they think about me," all you do is think about what other people think about you, because people that really don't give a crap what other people think about them, people that don't give a crap what other people think about them, don't say, "I don't give a crap what other people think about me." They say things like "past assault," but they don't say that shit. You know what I mean? The only people that say that shit is alcoholics who are in denial, who are trying to make believe that they're bigger, stronger, and more able than they really are, when they're really thumb-sucking crybabies. And so they lie to themselves. They're like their own cheerleader when they know deep down inside their whole life is dependent upon their crush if they think somebody doesn't like them. They're just in total bondage. So the Bill Wilson said, the next frontier is emotional sobriety. And so our real problem is that we have unhealthy dependencies. Depend upon whether you like me, whether I like me, what's going on. I want that freedom. I want that new freedom, that new happiness. I want that stuff that's going on. I want that Al Kennedy sobriety. We never apologize to anybody for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is weakness. Paradoxically, as a way of strength, the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. I guess that means you can get in front of a couple hundred people and talk about God. Even if there may be a bunch of people that don't like you because of it, I guess you can just do that stuff because it doesn't bother you, because your sobriety and who you are and what you are and what you know you are doesn't depend upon whether the pathway to power group likes me or not. Spent years trying to get that deal. And if I could only have that deal where I could be strong in myself and strong in God and not worry about you. And that's like gold. You'd be the richest guy in the world. You get to the place where, you know, it's just you and God. And you're just doing your thing, trying to help other people and love on other people. And man, I'll tell you, that's the real deal. Instead, we let him demonstrate to us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be at once we commence to outgrow fear. How would you like to outgrow that anxiety? Not to have that, be in the world but not be of the world. You know, in this world you'll have problems, but you've got to be of good cheer because you can overcome the world. You can overcome that shit. That's what this is all about. This is about overcoming alcoholism. Just because you're not drinking doesn't mean you've overcome alcoholism. That's the deal on that deal, which I think Tony was talking about. So here's what it says, you know, when we were talking about following those guys around, those miners around, I don't know how many of you guys have heard that tape on the miners. It would be hard to estimate, this is on Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, Bill Dotson, the guy in the bed, The guy they were holding the Bible, they were talking over and everything, the alcoholic, this is what he said. He was about 3 or 4 months sober. Bill Wilson was at his house. He said, it would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, of something that I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. When I was 4 months sober, my sponsor took me to a meeting. You know, that mean sponsor I had. The guy who said, you know, when they advanced the $500 check, he said, well, how would you feel? I was yelling and screaming. I said, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what are you talking about? Because he used to say shit like that. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? I mean, I said, how would I feel? What do you mean, how would I feel? He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what are you talking about? I didn't even understand. You know, it's like Greek. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what do you mean, how would I feel if it didn't bother me? He said, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? How would I feel if it didn't bother me that the asshole bounced a $500 check on me? He says, yeah, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, if it didn't bother me. He says, if it didn't bother you. I said, well, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel fine. He said, there you go. I go up to him, I say, I don't have enough money to make the mortgage. I don't know what's got my wife. I don't know what's got this. I got real money. I got money problems. I mean, God is good and A is good, but what happens if you got money problems? You know what I mean? And I need money. And he says to me, he says, okay, I understand that. He says, you know, I think it's about time you make coffee for the group. I said, no, I'm talking about my mortgage. He says, yeah, but I think you haven't made coffee for the group, have you? I said, I could sense there was no conversation going on. This guy was so stupid, you know what I mean? You know, but what can I do? He's my sponsor, and I didn't want to drink or anything else, and I knew him having a race over there, some dude would not drink, so he showed me how to make coffee. He started making the coffee. I don't know what happened. I got into making the coffee. Somehow the mortgage got paid. Everything worked out. Some guy came up to me like 2 weeks later and said, I'll make coffee. He said, this is my job. You know what I mean? Son of a bitch, you know? Who do you think you are? I'm the coffee maker for this group. You know, I don't know. It says, I really wanted the program. I wanted others to go along with it. I noticed that others seem to have such a release of happiness. So I could take you to this guy, Al Kennedy. So I'm at this meeting. And this guy, Al Kennedy, is talking. He's talking, and I'm watching this guy. And you see this guy, and I'm watching this guy. I was like transfixed, you know. He was strong, but he wasn't arrogant. He was loving, but he wasn't weak. He was the kind of guy, you ever meet somebody that when you're in your presence, you're hanging out with them, and you leave them, and you just feel better about, you just feel good about being around them. You just want to keep on, they're like a program of attraction, rather than, they're attracted. You say, man, if I can just hang out with that guy, every time I hang out with him, no matter what my problem is, no matter what I talk about, I always feel better. He always has the answers. He's always, you know, it's just something going. And this guy is talking to the group, and he's lifting people up, and he's loving on people. And he's got like about 30 years, and I'm watching him and saying, man, how does he do that? He's like transparent. It was almost like you were in his living room. It was almost like he didn't care what you thought about him. You know what I mean? He was just like being honest and talking to people and loving on him. And he left, and I turned to my sponsor. Now, I was there when this happened. You can't make this crap up. I mean, I watched this deal. You know what I mean? I watched this deal. I'm a witness. I saw the nail marks, man. I was there. And my sponsor said, I said, he's great. I said, he said, well, you know, he's dying. And I said, because my sponsor always said stupid shit. He once told me, when I told him I didn't have to go to meetings on Thursday, he said, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. And I sat there. I had graduated Department of Law and Mathematics, Division Chief in the State Attorney's Office, National Science Foundation Fellowship. I've been alive over 32, 33 years. Nobody had ever said anything close to that, like, to me. You know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. I thought he was complimenting me. I wasn't sure. I started thinking about a doggy family, like a doggy father and like a doggy mother. Because I'm trying to figure out, you know, as much about it. And then somewhere in the middle of it, I realized, hey, a dog doesn't know his father. So he says, he's dying. I said, what do you mean he's dying? He says, he's dying. I said, no, I'm talking about Al Kennedy, the guy who just did the meeting. He says, he's dying, Russ. He's got terminal cancer. He's got 6 months to live, 3 months. Yeah, I think 6 months later, he's dying. And I say to him, because I'm used to going to discussion meetings. I mean, can you imagine a guy dying of terminal cancer, he doesn't mention it? I said, but he didn't say anything about it. He says, I know. He didn't even hint. He didn't even act. You know, I would have said, well, it's good to be here with the Pathway Power Group. I says, you know, I'm dying of cancer, but I wanted to make it here. And, you know, just, you know, and didn't even mention it or do anything like that. And I said, he didn't. He says, I know. And I looked at, I met guys like that. I met the miners, you know what I mean? And I knew, you see this first statement? Just like this guy. He says this. He says, I noticed that others seem to have such a release, a happiness, a something that I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. Man, this guy wrote this like 50 years ago, and I was experiencing the same thing. I was watching these guys, and I was sober 3 or 4 months, and I knew there was something more. I knew there was something I hadn't got, because all I did was sit around all day and worry about myself. And all I did was have high anxiety. And every day, and every second, and every minute of the day, there was something going on in my life that I can't believe this is happening to me again! You know? They don't know who they're screwing with. Why is this always happening to me? In a traffic jam with 10,000 cars. Why me? I'll tell you a story about that. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't gotten. Here's a guy's dying of cancer, and he's doing an AME, he doesn't even mention it. And he's happy. He's happy to be there. He's privileged. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't gotten. And I remember one day, a week or two after I had come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We're eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Why they had this release. Bill looked across at my wife and said, Henrietta, the Lord, that's what he said. He said, the Lord, he didn't say the higher power. He said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. That's why I'm here. That's my motivation. I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing that he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep telling people about it, has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. And I belong to a fellowship where people are scared to talk about God or even mention the word God, and they try to, you know, they badmouth religion. They badmouth the Catholic Church. They badmouth churches. They badmouth clergy. They badmouth people. When I'm reading a book, I mean, what do I believe? The wisdom of the rooms, you know? You know, I mean, this ain't exactly Well People's Anonymous, you know? You know what I mean? This is pure AA being filtered through a whole bunch of people that are sick, crazy, and don't really want to do it. Do I believe the wisdom of the rooms, or I believe this book? When the book says we lose all prejudice, even against organized religion, we believe to see where religious people are right. And that's about the second step and the third step and about how we look at people and how we look at things. Do I believe the book? I believe the guy in the front row who's got 10 years that says, religion is a piece of crap and the church is bullshit. And I think that's AA, and all that is untreated alcoholism by a guy who still has not surrendered and has a resentment, and he's sponsoring people. But you want to know something? We all got our lives to lead, and you can do anything you want. It's ain't a dress rehearsal, and you go to the end of this life and say, why did I do it that way? And I know why you did it that way. You did it that way because you were scared to speak up in a room, and you didn't have the courage, and you worried about what other people thought about you. And, you know, if you say God or you do this, they're gonna treat you like crap or something like that. I don't know what I guess when I was 20 years sober, when I finally realized that they can't fire you from this crap. I really can't. You know, you can say Jesus, you can say God, you can say anything you want, you bring Bible, they can't fire you. They can't do anything to you. All they can do is not like you, you know what I mean? And what does it matter if they don't like you? That's their problem. You know, you walk out, I like me. You know, I mean, I'm the only me I know, you know. And then I'm going to read the last thing, and then I'm going to go into a couple more things, and then we're going to close it up. And this is from the book, from He Sold Himself Short. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am. Over my AA years, I've made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great. Don't have a lot of shit. But I have a fortune. Here it comes. Here comes the payoff. Here's the payoff. I have, you know, this is one of the guys in the old time. This is pre-big book shit. This is one of the guys that was thoroughly following the path they were following back then when they were closer to the path. This is the big book crap. This is what they had. I don't know what AA is for you. This is what AA is for me. This is what this has to offer. But I have a fortune in friendships, in courage, in self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, what do you suppose his above all is? What would you guess his above all is? Above all, I have gained the greatest thing according to any man. What do you think the greatest thing would be that he, a guy who was close to the deal, close to these guys, close to this fellowship, what do you think the greatest thing would be more than anything else? The greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God. The love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I've been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. I was sitting in a diner 10 o'clock at night, about 25, 30 years ago, with some guy who had a couple of weeks, younger guy. We had just gone to a meeting, and took him to a meeting on Saturday night. And, you know, for alcohol, Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week if you don't have a date or something like that. And we were there, and I was talking about the program and talking about the deal, and he looked at me and he said, well, you know, that meeting was pretty good, but what do you guys do for fun? I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was having a great time. This is AA Valhalla, you know? I'm going to sort of close with this because it really is, it's a true story. And it basically tells the deal as to what I've been doing. There's in 1863... there was a town called Bannock, Montana. And it was the scene right around Bannock, Montana in 1863, around the end of the Civil War. It was the scene of the second largest gold and silver strike in the United States. And the way that came about, and this is a true story, it's amazing. The way this came about is there were a whole bunch of miners, there were about 300 of them, that went out from Bannock to look for gold and silver in the Black Hills, which was Crow country. They weren't supposed to go by treaty, but they went there anyway. And about two or three days later, there were seven other miners that were following them that went out. And the seven other miners, I don't remember all their names. You know, I used to know their names, but two of the main guys were a guy named Bill Fairweather, okay, and Henry Edgar. And these guys, and they got captured by Indians. And they actually got away, except for one guy who was like a half-breed, stayed back, and they got away. Six guys got away, and they were going back to Bannock, Montana. They were out of supplies, and they stopped at a creek called Grasshopper Creek, and it was also called Alder's Gulch. And Bill Fairweather and Henry Edgar, while the other guys were getting firewood, went and they saw some rim rock, and they were sort of tapping at the rim rock, you know, doing what prospectors do, and they found a bunch of gold. You know, I mean, just imagine if you're out there in your backyard and you're tapping for about an hour or two and you gather up about $2,000 worth of gold. You know, I mean, this is big money. And they knew when the other guys came back, they knew that they had hit a big strike. And, you know, they were worried because back then, if you hit a big strike, you had to file the claim, you had to mine the claim. You always worried about claim jumpers and stuff like that. And they knew they had hit a big deal. And so they made a pact, because they were out of supplies, that they would go back to Bannock, Montana. And what they would do is they would get some more supplies. They would get some supplies. And then they would all meet at the old oak tree. And then they'd go back and they'd do the mine. And this, by the way, this mine turned out to be the second largest. It was used hundreds of millions of dollars. And we're talking about millions of dollars, it could have been billions by our stands, were taken out of this deal. So the bottom line is that they went back to Bannock, and here was the key. Nobody was supposed to say anything to anybody. Not even look at anybody. You know what I mean? Grab the stuff and run. You know, Santos Tropicana. Anybody know who Santos Tropicana is? This old mafioso guy died in Tampa. He used to have a saying, the only way you keep a secret among three people is two have to be dead. So he said, so what happened is, so the deal is that they were, they went to Bannock, they got supplies, and they were going back to the old oak tree, and they looked behind, there were a couple hundred miners following them. So, they knew, Fairweather knew somebody had talked. Somebody had talked. So when they caught up with them, he said to them, he said, who spilled the beans? Who talked? And the guy who was leading the group said, nobody. He said, nobody talked? He says, nobody talked. He said, this is what he said. This is exactly what he said. He says, we could see it in your eyes. He said, we could see it in your eyes. They could not hide. They could not hide their excitement. It's like you went to the Reading Digest $1 million deal. It's delivered to you, and you go to an A meeting, but you're not going to tell anybody. It's like something's changed. You know what I mean? They could see it in their eyes. And all I've been doing for 34 years is hanging out with the miners. Hanging out with, you know, there's leaders in AA. Did you know there were leaders in AA? You didn't know that? We have a tradition that says you can always tell leaders. They're servants. Just like God is a servant, in a sense. He serves us. He wants us to serve other people. You know, we have a line in our book with, once you make this decision for God, all sorts of remarkable things happen. This is right in the big book. Being all powerful. By the way, he's not a higher power. He's the highest power. I don't know about you, but I got serious alcoholism. I don't need no deputy frickin' power. You know what I mean? I need the highest guy. You know what I mean? Because I deal with the IRS. I need the big shot. You know what I mean? It says, being all powerful, he gives us everything we need if we stay close to him and perform his work well. We start losing concerns about our little plans and designs. We start having concerns for other people and how we can contribute to life. You know, no matter how, and then you know what it says? We start realizing his presence. You have a feeling of God's presence in your life. So you don't have that empty feeling anymore. You know, I don't care whether you're with 300 people. I don't care whether you're married, you're an alcoholic, you're empty. You're empty, you're lonely, you're alone. You know, you feel God's presence in your life. You're never alone. He's always with you. You talk to him all the time. I mean, you know, what better person to talk to than God? You know, it stops you from talking to all those other voices that are telling you you're a piece of shit and you're going to die. You know, because he doesn't tell you stuff like that. It says you lose fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter, you're reborn. I mean, that's what my big book says. That's what this program is all about. When do I hear that stuff talked about in Alcoholics Anonymous? That's why I love to see groups like this. You know, I was talking the way up here. I said, man, it's so refreshing to have a group that's focused on the big book. You hear about, you know, you guys, I'll email to anybody this essay on a strong cup of tea. Because, you know, when a bunch of alcoholics learn that you can actually stay sober for 5, 10, or 15 years and not really work this thing, and not really believe in God, not really do this thing, sort of hang out at meetings and collect medallions and stuff like that. If you got alcoholics who are given a choice, you can do this thing and stay sober or not do this thing and stay sober, what do you think most of them do? Man, it's a narrow road and through few go there. Broad highway, many follow, you know? We prefer not to do the work. What I want is I want to not to drink and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. Think what I want to think anyway and not change and get out of my face. I got my program. You got your program. And all I've been doing is hanging around. Thank God I was exposed to these guys. That's all I can say. And I thank God that he's allowed me to come up here and talk to you. And I hope this group continues to grow and prosper. God bless you. Thank you.